Ok, so. Inverse filter. What is an inverse filter? An inverse filter is a system which performs a modification of the signal such that it corrects completely for the effects of the original system. The original system was perhaps a light fixture, was perhaps a room, or was perhaps a telephone line, I don't know, is a system. It distorts the signal, it changes the frequency response, the phase, it makes bad things to the signal. We want to correct for those bad things employing a filter F which convolves with the transfer function of the original signal, of the original system, creates the Dirac delta function. That is perfectly flat spectrum, constant delay without any reverb, echoes, tail, nothing, a pulse. Packs the signal in time and flatten perfectly the spectrum, which of course in general is not possible. It does not exist mathematically a filter designed this way. We would like to have it, but we can't. And for many, many years, this mathematical impossibility, which can be proved, there is a theory which proves that is not possible, was preventing engineers by attempting this approach. More recently, it was understood that L2, it is impossible to find an exact inverse filter. It is quite possible to find an approximate inverse filter, which from a psychoacoustical point of view is the same as the theoretical one, because we don't hear the difference between the two. So in practice, what is forbidden by the theory, in reality is possible. Okay? Well, those are in Italian, sorry, I did not take time to translate. In practice, this is possible if the system is linear. This is still a problem which has not been solved if the system is not linear. So we need to explain what a linear system means. A system is called linear when the effect superposition theory holds. What is the superposition theory? Means that if you feed a system with a signal A, it has a certain output. Then you feed a system with a signal B, it has a different output. You feed your system with a signal which is the sum of A plus B, the response of the system will be the sum of the response to A and the sum to the response to B. So if you sum the inputs, you get summed the output. This is the concept of linearity. It's a very precise concept. Most people, thinking of linearity, think another thing. They think a linear system is a flat frequency response. Wrong. There are systems which have a completely not flat frequency response, but still they are consistent with this definition of linearity. So it's not true that a linear system is flat. A linear system does not have echo. Again, wrong. There are linear systems with a lot of reverb and echo, but still the system is perfectly linear because it passes the superposition test. So linearity is a quite broad concept. One very simple way to check if a system is linear or not is to inject a pure tone, a sinusoid. If you inject a pure tone with a given frequency, a linear system will output a pure tone at the same frequency. It can be louder or weaker, it can be delayed, but it will remain a pure tone. If instead you get something different by a pure tone, that is broadband noise or a number of peaks in frequency domain like harmonics or not harmonics peak, then the system is not linear. But the definition is with the superposition. The definition is not given in terms of response to a pure tone. In the practical way, is a quick and dirt check of linearity to play a pure tone and see if another pure tone comes out at the same frequency. This is usually a condition of linearity. So in practice, in a not linear system, the transfer function of the system is not invariant. It depends on the signal being injected. So you cannot characterize the system with a concept like the impulse response, because the impulse response is an invariant thing. If the transfer function of the system changes depending on the signal being applied, particularly on the amplitude of the signal being applied, you understand that for a not linear system, you cannot apply anything of what we have explained you in the whole course of acoustics. Acoustics is based on the hypothesis of linearity. As acoustical systems are linear, then we can search for an inverse filter of an acoustical system. And here we have an example. We have a source of signal, a CD player. Here we insert our filtering block, which usually is called an equalizer, but is a generic word, is a filter, which is there for ameliorating the response of your system. Then you have the real system made by an amplifier, a loudspeaker, the room where the sound propagates, and the microphone which receives the signal. If the filter does his job, the signal which was on the CD make a short route, and the very same signal which was on the CD, you find it back. Is white, I don't know why. In color. Okay. The signal coming from the CD player arrives without any alteration at the end of the system, because the filter is compensating all the bad things happening after. This is a pre-filtering. In another scheme, you could not take the filter here and apply the filtering after recording the signal with the microphone. As everything is linear, applying the filter here or after is exactly the same. It doesn't change the result. So in practice, in a block scheme, you have your input signal X, you have your filter F, you have your system impulse response H, and you have the output, which is not anymore Y, but it is called X first. And if the things work, X first is more or less equal, more or less equal to X. If the filter is doing his job, the output is the same as the input. Okay? Delay, of course, but apart from absolute delay, is the same. Mathematically, we write that the output is the input convolved F convolved H, but as F convolved H by definition provides the Dirac delta function, in practice Y equate X with some delay. There are different ways, different technologies for computing the coefficient of the FIR filter F. The older one is the technique by John Morgiopoulos, a Greek scientist working in Patras but he did study in Southampton, ISVR, Institute of Sound and Vibration Research. He was doing his PhD there in the 80s. In the same period, I was there also as a PhD student. So we actually met there for the first time. The Morgiopoulos method is implemented in time domain, is very slow, and nowadays it is obsolete. But it was the first historically available method for computing an inverse filter for an electroacoustical system. So historically is very important, the Morgiopoulos method. Then there was another method invented by two American scientists called Neely and Allen, which for the first time made the search for the inverse filter in frequency domain. But the Neely and Allen inverse filter only correct for the magnitude of the transfer function of the system, not for the phase. So the inverse filter obtained with Neely and Allen flattened the response of the loudspeaker of the room in terms of spectrum, make the spectrum flat, but does not correct for reverb, delay, the reverberant tail, and so on, or for echoes. It are not corrected because it is a filter which is called linear phase filter, which really does not change the phase of the system. It only corrects the magnitude. Finally, we have the more recent one, Nelson and Kirkeby, again Southampton, ISVR. Actually, Professor Nelson was the professor of both me and Morgiopoulos. But 10 years later, in the 96-97, Ole Kirkeby, a Danish scientist, again was doing his PhD in Southampton. The same history as for me and Mr. Morgiopoulos. And 10 years later, the two invented final the currently employed method of computing in the inverse filter, which works in frequency domain. So you start from the impulse response of your system, go with the FFT in frequency domain, and when you are in frequency domain, you compute the inverse filter. In this case, you invert also the phase. And the trick of Mr. Kirkeby was to add a small positive quantity at the denominator of the fraction, which is called the regularization parameter, which avoids to divide by zero in practice. And avoiding to divide by zero, you limit the height of the peak of your inverse filter, and if you limit the peaks, you make it short in time domain. For the same reason we were explaining at the beginning, if something is very peaky in frequency domain, it's going to be very long in time domain, but you cannot take the inverse filter too long. So the regularization parameter also shortens the filter in time domain, making it fitting within the prefixed length of the filter. Let me see this last theory, which is the only one to be used now and in the future. So, step one, you get your impulse response, H, of your system. You FFT transform it and go to frequency domain. We follow the convention that the spectral quantity, the complex number, are with the capital letter, while the time domain function, the corresponding time domain signal, are written with the lowercase letter, small h, okay? At the second step, we make the reciprocal of h in frequency domain. But instead of just writing 1 less h, which will go crazy when h is 0, we employ a more tricky formula, the Kirkeby formula, this one, in which you make the ratio between the complex conjugate of H divide the complex conjugate of H multiplied H. What is here is the autospectrum. You remember we define this as the autospectrum of the signal, plus this regularization parameter, epsilon. In the original Kirkeby formulation, epsilon was constant. There was no dependence of epsilon by the frequency. At this point, you come back to time domain, and that is your filter. It's so simple. It's really very simple. The only trick is to add the small quantity at the denominator. In the original Kirkeby formulation, epsilon was just a small constant value, like 0.001, a small number. Doesn't matter really. Just not zero. Small, but not zero. Currently, this regularization parameter is not any more constant with frequency, and that is my modification to this algorithm. So now that's called the Nelson-Kirkeby-Farina formula, in which epsilon depends on frequency. And the optimal dependence of the regularization parameter with frequency is, as shown in this slide, a small value at the central frequency range where the measurement was accurate and where the inversion makes sense, because we are hearing the sound in this region. At very low frequency, infrasound, and at very high frequency, ultrasound, there is no need to invert the system, because we are not hearing that. So we give up, with a large value of the regularization parameter. This way, we are not wasting filtering capability for filtering the signal below 20 Hz and above 20 kHz, where it doesn't matter for us because we are not hearing, so why correcting the signal outbound? For certain applications, the band can be smaller. For example, over a telephone line, where the bandwidth of the microphone and the loudspeaker goes only between 200 Hz and 4 kHz, there is no point in correcting the transfer function of a telephone line outside these two limits, because the bandwidth of the system is only 200 Hz to 4 kHz. So in this case, you reduce these F-low and F-high values to a smaller range. So you decide which is the range where you want to have the accurate inversion, and you decide what is outside, and you are not dealing with it. So in practice, when you have a system like this one with an inverse field, with a transfer function of the system which is disrupting your information, so the signal has been distorted by your system. If you instead insert a new filter before, this is the example with the filter. So first you have the system without filter, the original signal, which does not let me increase slightly the gain, sorry. Okay. We have the original signal. This is the transfer function of your system, and this is the filter, the system filtered, the signal filtered from the system. So the frequency response has been changed and some reverb has been inserted. If we now insert here your filter, here to the sound of the filter, zwing, zwing, this zwing is the attempt of correcting the phase response, the reverb. So this filter applied to your signal creates a pre-filtered signal which sounds strange. It's horrible. But this horrible signal is pre-distorted, opposite to the distortion of your system. So when you feed to your loudspeaker this pre-filtered system signal and this pass through the system, at the end you get a signal which is almost identical to the original one. It has been re-recorded with the mic. Almost the same as the original one. So your pre-filter corrected completely for the effect of the system. And this is very effective. You see, the filtering coefficient can be applied before or after. If you post-filter your signal passed through the system, you get the same result. It's absolutely the same to apply the filter after recording the output of the system or before feeding the signal to the system. It's identical because those are all linear systems. Now we try to dope it in reality. First of all, we measure very quickly the impulse response of the loudspeaker of this computer, so we generate a sine sweep between, say, 100 Hz to 20 kHz, 10 seconds, okay. We record the impulse this way, okay. Insert here. Start again, sorry. Sometimes it crash. So, generate the sine sweep between 200 and 20 kHz. 10, 5, everything is okay. Okay. Go here, insert the sweep, record the response of the microphone. Let's make the measurement. No. Something is wrong with the recording. Ah, because yesterday I did record with an external sound card. So probably now the device are wrong. This is correct. Okay. And the input board. Okay, now it's fine. Record in one, left, properties. Okay. Too loud. Try again. Okay, convolve with clipboard for getting the impulse response. This is the impulse response of our system. We now try to perform an inverse filter of this thing. Okay. This is the H. Let me save it as H. VV Acoustic Public Acoustic Course. Wait. We call this H, small case, because it's time domain. Now we have the signal H, we want the inverse filter. For getting the inverse filter we have a special Kirchhoff plugin, this one. We define the length of the inverse filter, I think 2 kilo point is fine. The inbound regularization parameter, remember this picture here. Remember this picture here, it is this value here in the between. The inbound, the outbound value is 1000 times larger, you see, much larger. The frequency range in this case is between, say, 250 Hz up to 15 kHz, perhaps. Okay. And this is the transition width between the low and high frequency range, the inbound and outbound value. I think everything should be fine, no average, outer range. Okay, let's compute the inverse filter. This is the inverse filter. There is some ringing here, which is not nice. The inverse filter has been stored in the Windows clipboard. Edit, fast to new. Yeah, there is this ringing which is happening at 2 kHz, you see. The ringing happens at 2 kHz. Not nice. Why we have such a peak? Because in the original signal, probably there was a hole. There was a notch. As there were notch at some frequencies, these notches are causing problem in the inverse filter. What is the reason for this notch in the inverse, in the original transfer function of the system? Because we are recording with one microphone and we were playing signal with two loudspeakers. The two loudspeakers are not the same distance from the microphone, so they arrive with some delay. You should see here that there are two peaks. One peak and another peak. Two peaks means that in frequency domain there is this periodic notch, which is called comb filtering. Okay, but we don't care too much. This is our inverse filter. Okay. If we now convolve the original transfer function of our system with the inverse filter of our system, we see if the inverse filter is good enough. If it creates the Dirac delta function, it is a good inverse filter. If it does not create the correct Dirac delta function, it's wrong, and we start again. Well, it's almost good, because it created this peak in the center. But there are some artifacts before and after. Those are not nice. One of the possible reasons was the regularization parameter was too small. So we start again. We come back to our signal and we try another inversion, increasing by 10, for example, the value of the regularization parameter. Still a lot of ringing. Make the convolution. Is a trial and error approach. No, the problem is still there. Another trick is to search for a longer inverse filter. Instead of 2 kilo points, let me use a much longer inverse filter, hoping that the signal decays to zero at the end. Now it's nice. Now we convolve with this one, and now it's perfect. So what we have got after three attempts, actually, is an inverse filter which perfectly inverts the complex transfer function of the sound system of this Mac. Okay? And you can do the same for a professional loudspeaker, for a sound amplification like the one in this room. You just place the microphone in front of the loudspeaker, measure the transfer function, make the inverse filter. What you do with your inverse filter? You insert it inside your sound processing chain. Now, the sound processing chain here starts from this microphone, goes to this wireless device. The receiver is there, where there is probably also the power amplifier feeding the loudspeaker. There are hardware devices to be inserted in that rack, which are digitally programmable filter units. You insert one of such devices there inside the chain of transmission, loaded with the coefficient of this filter, pass to new. This is our filter. It is 8 kilo point long, which is nothing for a modern DSP. They can perform filters 10 times longer, so not a problem, 8 kilo point today. 10 years ago it was impossible, but nowadays an 8 kilo point filter is nothing. You load this filter, this coefficient inside the filter, inside the rack, perhaps connecting with a USB cable the computer, or just connecting the USB stick to the digital processing unit installed there. You load the coefficient and then your system is equalized. It's simple. In many professional applications nowadays, there is a DSP unit, it's called. DSP stands for Digital Signal Processing, inserted in the system and loaded with coefficient computed this way or in a similar way. Everything is clear? Okay. So, we call this F. Then I will load both of those signals on the website, so you can retrieve them, and you can try starting back from H to perform, let me say this as H convolved F, HXF. This is the result, the check that the convolution of the filter with the system is correct. And if we look at the frequency response, it's almost flat. Here, there is still a small notch which has not been completely corrected due to the limited value of the regularization parameter, which did not allow for perfect filtering. So this is an approximate filter, but the approximation is so small that we cannot hear this small notch here. So actually, in the practical world, this filter is perfect. In reality, if you look mathematically, you see a small notch because we used a regularization parameter which prevented the peak of the filter to be as large as it should be for completely correcting this problem. Okay, we still have half an hour. Close this one and go to the last part of the lesson. Okay, now the topic is how to measure the absorption coefficient of material. We did already introduce one approach for measuring the absorption coefficient of material. In that approach, we did employ a reverberant room, and we did perform the measurement of the empty room and of the room with some absorbing material inside. By the reduction of reverberation time, we can estimate the absorption of the absorption coefficient of the material which we have inserted. Remember that the acoustical absorption coefficient really does not take into account if the energy is really absorbed inside the material or if it is transmitted in the room next to our one, because our is an apparent absorption coefficient, okay? It is alpha, is not A. We know four methods for measuring the absorption coefficient. The first one is the one in reverberant room. ISO 354 is the international standard dealing with this kind of measurement in the reverberant room. And we did already explain this to you. Measure the reverberation time with the room empty, insert 10 square meters of material, measure again the reverberation time. The reverberation time is shorter. You use the Sabin formula for estimating the absorption coefficient of material. But we also know the problem of this method. What comes out is the so-called Sabin absorption coefficient, because it comes out from the Sabin formula, which can be strange, which can be funny, which can be larger than one. So there are other three methods which are more scientific, aiming to provide the true value of the absorption coefficient. The first one does not provide the true value of the absorption coefficient. It provides the Sabin absorption coefficient, which in general is larger than reality, is falsely larger. So the three methods are the standing wave tube, where you make pressure measurement, the impulsive method, according to standard EN, European standard, 7093/5. Or the last one, which is my method, I must say, is the intensity method, sound intensity method. This can work either inside a pipe, like this one, or in free field, like this one. Now, let me look quickly into this method. This is the reverberant room. You first measure the empty room, and you get a first value of reverberation time called TE, E stands for empty, and the second measurement is repeated when in the room you place it on the floor 10 square meters of your carpet or for your absorbing material, and of course you measure a second value of reverberation time, TS. S means sample, with the sample inside, and this is of course smaller than TE, because your material absorbs, so it reduces the reverberation time. As we can write in the first case the Sabin formula for the empty room, and in this formula you know T, so the unknown is the absorption area of the empty room, and you compute AE. Then you write again the Sabin equation for the room with the sample inside, and the formula is the same, but now at the denominator you have an additional absorption, which is given by the absorption coefficient of your material multiplied the surface, which is 10 square meter of the material which you inserted. Now IE is known by solving the formula here. So in practice, you get the value of IE from here and insert here. So now in this formula, the only unknown is alpha, and you extract it and compute. The resulting formula is this one, if you work out the thing. So this gives you directly alpha, knowing the two value of reverberation time. The problem with this approach is that the result is not the true absorption coefficient. It's just the magic number which makes the Sabin formula to work in the second case. But the Sabin formula works only when the absorption is uniform all around in the room. Instead, in this room, most of the surface was not absorbing, and only a small portion of 10 square meter was highly absorbing. This violates the Sabin formula assumption. So the formula doesn't hold really in this situation. And so the value of alpha, which you insert here for explaining the measured reverberation time, is not the true absorption of the material, is the Sabin absorption coefficient, which can be much larger than one. Here you see the result of ISO 354 measurement of carpets of mineral walls of different thickness, you see. And in many cases, you measure values larger than one. This is typical with this method. Up to 1.20, but with some other material, those with an uneven surface, you know, with those pyramids or similar things, you can get even 1.4, a very large value, much larger than one, which makes no sense from an energetical point of view. But this is what the standard describes, and that is called the Sabin alpha, alpha Sabin. This is the second method, the Kundt tube, or standing wave apparatus. Is a pipe of steel with a diameter typically of 10 cm, which is long a couple of meters. Here there is a loudspeaker, and through this rod you move a microphone along the pipe. At the end of the pipe there is a sample holder with a screw for closing it carefully, and inside this sample holder you place a disc, a round disc of 10 cm diameter. You must cut it very carefully of the precise diameter of the carpet or of the material which you are measuring. So it is only good for flat material like this one, of course. Inside such a pipe, you cannot measure complex structure with funny shapes. It must be just a disc of material thin and flat. You insert it there, and then you play sound with the loudspeaker, and you move the microphone along the pipe. You play a pure tone. So with this kind of apparatus, you must repeat the measurement many times at different frequency, 100 Hz and you move the microphone, 125 and you move the microphone, 106 and you move the microphone. Making a complete measurement can require half an hour or so. At every frequency, you move the microphone, searching for maximum and minimum values, because the sound pressure inside the pipe fluctuates between a maximum and a minimum. If the surface is completely reflecting, alpha equals zero, the reflection coefficient R is one, the same energy goes to the wall and the same energy comes back. At this point, you get complete cancellation, zero pressure. This is an ideal case, a maximum case of a material without any absorption. When here you have a layer of carpet, you get a fluctuation between a maximum pressure and a minimum pressure value, but the minimum one is not zero anymore, because the reflected energy is less than the incident energy, so the pressure field does not cancel completely at this point. We called standing wave ratio, SWR, the ratio between the maximum pressure and the minimum pressure. The maximum pressure is given by the sum of the incident pressure, PI, and the reflected pressure, PR. The minimum pressure is given by the difference by the incident pressure, PI, and the reflected pressure, PR. If you remember that alpha is defined as 1 minus R, if you remember the definition of the absorption coefficient, alpha is 1 minus R. That is 1 minus the ratio between the square reflected pressure PR squared divide the incident PI squared. Okay, this was the definition of alpha. As we know, the ratio between incident and reflected energy, if you sum these two, you get twice PI. If you subtract the two, you get twice PR, the reflected pressure. You work out the math and you get this formula. Alpha equal 1 minus the ratio squared of standing wave ratio minus 1 divided standing wave ratio plus 1. It can be written in other way if you like. For example, if we work out everything explicitly in terms of Pmax and Pmin, writing again these two quantities, we can solve this equation system, this linear equation system, and get explicitly P incident and P reflected as the sum and the difference of the two measured pressure divided two. You substitute then in the definition of alpha and you get this other formula here, which is almost the same as before. But now you insert here directly Pmax and Pmin, subtracted and summed, squared. This is a very precise method. It's the reference method. Okay. This is the most scientific one, the one perfectly according to the definition, the one which is used for checking all the other methods. It has only two problems. It is slow because you make the measurement one frequency at time, at once. So one frequency, make the measurement, move the frequency, make another. It takes half an hour or 1 hour. Second point, locating the maximum value is easy because the area, the zone of maximum is broad. But locating the minimum is not so easy because the minimum is very thin, so moving the microphone along the pipe requires very careful search for finding the true minimum. So the operator must be very skilled. An unskilled operator gets wrong values of minimum pressure and gets wrong values of alpha. A well-trained operator makes very accurate and repeatable measurements. So it is a reference method in the lab, is not for everyday work. It takes too long and it requires a too expensive experienced experimenter, which is not currently available, for example, in the university labs, where our technicians are absolutely not trained enough for doing this job. So these are the problems which I told you the method cannot be easily automatized. It's a slow manual thing of the past. It's still the reference method, but it's not practical. Particularly not for making in-situ measurements, like for noise screen, which is a very important topic from the economical point of view. You are often asked to measure the absorption coefficient of noise screen along the road, and you are in the middle of the road, so the measurement must be fast because you are there. There is danger, the car can kill you, so you must place your system there and run away as quick as possible, possibly just in a few seconds you must do the measurement. Okay, so the method employed in this case is the so-called impulsive method. according to this European standard AN1793. You have a loudspeaker which can be turned because it is rotating here. You launch the sound against the screen, the noise screen, and you have a microphone here. The microphone captures an impulse response, either with MLS or sweep method, and we all know that sweep is better. So you get an impulse response. In this impulse response, you see two peaks. First peak is the direct sound. Second peak, later on in time, is when the reflected sound arrives to the microphone. So you see, this is the response when the system is mounted. The microphone is here, is the blue thing here, and the red thing here is the loudspeaker. And the system is launching sound against the noise screen here. So what you get actually is the direct sound here, which is the first peak, and this bad thing here is the reflection from the screen. If the screen was flat and reflective, then the response had been a nice peak like this one. As in this case, the noise screen has this complex structure shape, the reflection is not just one nice clean peak. The response is those dirty here. So it's not easy to separate the direct sound from the reflected sound. So the standard came out with a trick. You turn the loudspeaker against the sky and you make another measurement where we only get the free field, because you are not launching the sound anymore against the wall. You are launching it toward the sky, so nothing comes back. And this way you measure the free field only. Here you have free field plus reflection. Here you have free field only. How can you get the response of the barrier alone without the free field? By subtraction. If you subtract the first from the second, the direct sound comes away and you get only the reflected sound. At this point, you apply both to the direct sound and to the reflected sound the so-called Adrienne window. This window is called Adrienne because it was the result of a 5 million euros European project. They did spend 5 million euros for understanding that you need to apply a window. The reason for the window is the same I did explain in the previous lesson before doing FFT. Always before doing FFT you need to apply a window which brings the signal to zero at the beginning and at the end of the window. They did spend 5 million of European Community funds for defining this asymmetrical window. As you see, is very sharp at the beginning and very slow at the end, with an optimal length which resulted to be 8 milliseconds. And you apply this window both to the direct sound, you see here, and to the reflected sound. The direct sound and the reflected sound are windowed with the Adrienne window. Of course, you make the FFT of each of these two pieces of signal, of these two blocks of data. You get two spectra. This is the direct sound spectrum, which is almost perfectly flat, if you have a good loudspeaker with a proper Kirchhoff inverse filter. Here it is very important to apply a proper digital filter to your loudspeaker, so that it radiates a sound which is perfectly flat. The reflected sound, instead, is not flat at all. It's terrible, this reflected sound. You see how many peaks and valleys. And now you can apply directly the definition of alpha. Again, alpha is 1. Oops, sorry. alpha is 1 minus reflected energy divided incident energy. So the reflected energy is given by the spectrum below, the incident energy is the spectrum above, so T goes here and T goes here, and you can compute alpha at every frequency. Okay? It's easy. The method also allows for making the measurement not at normal incident, that is with the loudspeaker pointing exactly against the wall, but also tilting the loudspeaker at different angles. In this case, the measurement can become tricky because it can well happen that also the sound reflected by the ground arrives to the microphone. And as some part of the reflected sound is making a very long path, you cannot easily separate the sound reflected from the ground by the sound reflected by the barrier. In fact, if you see here, here this is ground reflection. It should not be there, but it is there, and it makes the measurement wrong. In practice, this method only works if the barrier is very, very tall, more than 6 meters. Only if the barrier is so tall, this method works accurately. If the barrier, as normal, is just a couple of meters or perhaps 3 meters, it is not tall enough for avoiding contamination from the ground reflection. So the absorption coefficient, which you get with this method, is wrong. And in general, don't trust two measurements made with this method, because this method is wrong. It provides wrong values. Okay? Well, there is a trick compensating for the distance, the different distance of the microphone from the real loudspeaker and from the image loudspeaker. You see, in practice, the wall works like a mirror, creating a mirror source here, as first. This mirror source is more distant from the microphone than the real source. So you should compensate by the time of flight, taking into account that the sound decreases with distance, and so you multiply by current time when doing those integrals for correcting for the different distance of the source from the real source and from the virtual source from the microphone. With this formula, the system works for an infinitely tall barrier, which is not diffusive, but it is specular. Under those assumptions, the formula is correct. In the real world, where the barrier has a limited height, and the surface is scattering, the method is wrong. And we published a paper 2 years ago showing how large can be the error. It can really be very large. It can be a factor of 4. So the estimated absorption coefficient can be 1/4 than the real value. It's completely wrong, this method. But it is a standard. This is one of the examples taken by my paper of 2 years ago. The green line is the measurement made with the reverberant room ISO 354. So, apart from the fact that the value is a bit exaggerated by the ISO 354 method, this is the real value of the absorption coefficient. And this is what has been measured with the new method with the impulsive technique. At many frequencies, the absorption coefficient is negative, which is completely nonsense. How can it reflect more energy than what is impinging over the barrier? It cannot be true. So this method, please, consider it a complete fault and consider that 5 million of euros from the European community has been completely wasted. Developing a method which doesn't work, standardizing it, publishing the standard, and now the big trouble is that people buying the barriers, like Autostrade per l'Italia, that is the company who owns the highways in Italy and who is the major purchaser of noise screen in Italy, they buy this barrier and they say, okay, let's qualify your products with this standard. So they ask to the maker of the barriers to perform this measurement after installation, and they compare this value with the value coming from the lab, which are the green line, and so they get this blue line here and say, oh, what a shit, you are trying to fool me. Those barriers are not the same you qualified in the lab. Those barriers are much lower quality. I am not going to pay you because the barriers mounted along the highway measure this way, while the original sample sent to the lab did measure this way. Instead, we did prove that's wrong by dismounting 10 square meters of barriers, which were not being paid for this reason, sending back to the laboratory in Turin and measuring, and this is the measurement. The sample was the same. It was not a similar barrier. It was the same piece of barrier, which was first measuring along the highway, then dismounted, sent to the lab, and measured again the same sample. So it is the measurement method which is wrong. It was not the piece of barrier which was not properly built. The barrier was the same, okay? So be aware of the problem with this measurement method. Well, according to the method, you are not actually writing the result in terms of alpha. You are computing a loss of decibel due to the reflection. When the sound is reflected, is weakened by a certain number of dB. You employ a normalized highway spectrum, which is this one, and you made a computation of the attenuation of the reflected sound with this formula here, summing 18 different frequency values. You make this evaluation and you get a single number, which is a number in dBA, telling you how much is attenuated, the sound being reflected back by the barrier. This is a nice concept because it makes for easy calculation. Particularly, if you are mounting the barrier on one side of the road, this tells you how loud will be the reflected sound going to the opposite direction. The level is going to increase due to the installation of the barrier. The barrier is effective, reducing the sound on the same side of the road where the barrier is mounted. But on the opposite side of the road, the sound is not reduced, it's boosted. How much it's boosted? If you know this number, you can compute easily, because if the barrier was perfectly reflective, it will be doubled, the sound, that is 3 decibels more. If the reflected sound is not exactly the same as the incident sound, but it is weaker, you can make the computation. Let me make a very simple example. This is the barrier, and this is the road with the car. This is the car here. Okay. My capability of drawing with the mouse is very limited, but you understand this is the car with the wheels. Okay, so for a receiver here, this is the receiver, when there was no barrier, here, the level, let's call L1, was probably 60 decibels, just a number. You have 60 decibels without the barrier. If the barrier was perfectly reflecting, then the reflected sound will be more or less other 6 decibels. So when you sum the reflected sound, let's call it L2, with the original sound, 60 plus 60 make 63. You sum and the result will be 63. But if the reflected sound is not reflected over a perfectly reflecting wall, but it is reflected off a wall which has a DL value of, for example, 5 decibel, which is a typical value for a rod barrier, having a reflection loss of 5 or 6 decibel, okay? You have this delta L or DL value of 5 decibel, the reflected sound will not be anymore 60, it will be 55. And if the reflected sound is 55, what's the result of summing 60 to 55? Let me compute. I use the Excel value, I have 60, I have 55, I make the sum 10 times the logarithm base 10 of 10 raised 60 less 10 plus 10 raised 55 less 10, closed. The result is 61.2. instead of 63. So here I don't write anymore 63. I write 61.2. So employing a screen with absorptive properties, still the level on the opposite side of the barrier is increased after installing the barrier, but instead of increasing 3 decibel, is now increased only 1.2 decibel. And the barrier had a reflection loss of 5 decibel. Okay? This is what's happening when using the screen only on one side of the road. The level on the opposite side increase, and knowing this number make it easy to compute how much the sound will increase for a receiver in the opposite side. Well, this is another example coming from my paper of 2 years ago. Barrier A was measured in the lab with an insertion loss, a reflection loss of 20 decibel, and measured with this impulsive method on situ, did measure only 4.5 decibel of reflection loss. Second barrier, not as good, had in the lab 12 decibel of reflection attenuation, and on situ did measure 3.4 decibel attenuation. In practice, as I said before, the performance obtained by this method is 1/4 of the performance measured in the lab. So this method is wrong. It can be used if you accept that if the measured value is 1/4 of the real value, then you correct. At this point, it makes sense. But if you just compare this number with this, they are not comparable, because this one is usually, on average, 1/4 of this one. You cannot compare directly. Okay? And then the last method. That's easy. What is shown here is a sound intensity probe. is a special measurement assembly of two microphones. Here, if you look carefully, you see two capsules with a solid spacer in between. This device measures sound intensity because it measures pressure, it measures particle velocity. The analyzer connected with this probe process the signal of pressure and the signal of velocity, making the product and computing sound intensity. Not only, it actually measures separately pressure, velocity and intensity. It measures three quantities, okay? At this point, when you know all these quantities, you can process your result of the measurement for computing the incident intensity and the reflected intensity. How can you do the computation? First of all, you need to compute a fourth quantity, which is called the energy density, ED. The probe measures the particle velocity, PV, the sound pressure, SP. This formula, which we already introduced in one of the first lessons of the course, compute the sum of the kinetic energy, these terms, and the potential energy, these other, giving you the total energy density of the sound field. At this point, the probe actually measured two quantities in the end, the energy density and sound intensity. Sound intensity can be thought to be the difference between the incident intensity, which is positive for us, and the reflected intensity, which is smaller and negative. So in practice, the vector being measured is not the upper one, is not the lower one, but it is a vector like this, which is actually the difference between the two. This one is the vector which is measured by the probe, because it makes the difference between what goes and what comes back. So the measured value are I dot, the total sound intensity, which is given by the difference between the incident and the reflected one. And you have measured the energy density. If you multiply the energy density for the sound speed, you find a quantity which can be explained as the sum of the incident and reflected energy, because the energy density is not a vector, it's a scalar, it's an energy. Energy is always positive. So energy always sum. In terms of energy density, the energy going this way and the energy going the opposite way, they sum. In terms of energy density, they subtract in terms of intensity vector. So, as you know, in practice, the sum and the difference of the incident and the reflected intensity, this again, like in the tube, is a linear equation system with two unknowns. You solve the system and you get the two unknown quantities, incident intensity and reflected intensity. And these are the very simple formula. And at this point, by definition, you define the reflection coefficient as the reflected energy divided the incident energy. You substitute the quantity, you can write it as you like, dividing and multiply by the energy density, multiply the speed of sound. But in the end, you have a simple formula which gives you R, the reflection coefficient, and of course alpha is 1 minus R. We did already introduce this ratio between active intensity and total energy density multiplied by C. This ratio is a magic number bounded between 0 and 1, which is called RE, RE, ratio of energy, and this value tends to 1 if the sound propagates and does not come back. And this ratio is 0 if you have a perfect reflecting material which reflects back everything, so you have a standing wave and the energy is not going anywhere. Okay? This provides a very accurate measurement of alpha, which you can perform inside the tube, if you like. If you can perform inside the room, like against this wall, you can perform outdoors for a noise screen, and you can perform in the lab inside the reverberation room. You can perform it everywhere. And the results are very consistent. You always get the same value, independent on the lab, or inside the tube, is always the same value, which is the true absorption coefficient, actually. So in practice, we did perform the sound intensity measurement on the same barrier which I've shown you before, and this is the result. Well, it's not exactly the same as the ISO 354, but we know that that value of ISO 354 is overestimated. So in practice, the sound intensity method is currently the most reliable method for measuring the absorption coefficient, both in the lab or in the field, like here. You can use the sound intensity method also in the pipe. So you can compare with exactly the same sample with the reference traditional method of the standing wave tube. As you see here, there is this pipe which contains both the sound intensity probe, these two microphones here, and there is the system for moving the normal microphone inside for measure. Actually, is here in this case the normal microphone, but it's the same. And you can measure the standing wave ratio and get the absorption coefficient that way. So you can check very side by side if the system works as expected. And it works. Okay? I think we have finished also for today. Any questions? Okay, see you next week.